Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. Today on the show, I'm joined with Tim Goldstein, as we're going to talk about why neurodivergent should change to neurodistinct. And we'll talk about other pleasant things about autism and everything else, and we'll learn more about him. So sit back, relax, and grab your favorite beverage, and I'll see you on the other side. See you there. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. Today, I'm joined with Tim Goldstein. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Hey, glad to be here, Reed. Thank you for having me.
Not a problem. So why don't you tell everyone a little bit about yourself, and we'll get going.
Well, a little bit about myself. I think probably most pertinent to this show particularly is I am autistic, and I was diagnosed at 54. So I'm one of the late diagnosis people, which I think is fairly common in my age group, because when we went to school, they didn't know about it. So we just went into the world and had to figure it out ourselves. Through my career, I, like a lot of autistic individuals, have had ups and downs, and done tremendously well and then got fired, and done tremendously well and then got fired. And, my original career was actually in the bicycle business. Started out low as you can be, sweeping floors and unwrapping bikes, and ended up doing national sales teams and international supply chains. And then I got fired. And at that point, I just ended up doing a series of just, like, I call them crappy jobs, but it was really good learning of what a lot of people have to, do to just make ends meet if they don't have skills. I was a college dropout, 1 year college dropout, but it was a valuable year. And then I ended up getting into tech, into the tech world. And once I got into the tech world, I found my home. I found my people, and I found my home, and loved it to death, and have been in the tech world now, gosh, 25 years or something. And that was, so that was about my fifth career. I did change multiple companies, got fired multiple times. So many times I wrote a book called Geek's Guide to Interviews, because I got really good at interviewing. That was the good thing of having a sales background, I guess, is you know how to sell the interviewers. And, now I work for, one of the, major global, internet companies that, go into those initials when they talk about the ones in the stock market. Have been fairly successful and enjoying myself there.
So when we last talked, you had mentioned you don't like the word neurodivergent. Why don't you like that word? I mean, what kind of emotion does it bring it up to you?
Well, I won't say it's so much an emotion. Maybe it's more of a learned thing. Along the way, I didn't mention I did have my own. I've had multiple companies. I had my own manufacturing company I ran for 10 years, designed, created lots of different products. And so I had to learn marketing. And the 1 year of college I took actually was for business, and did have, some actual real education in marketing. And it's really a marketing thing. When you look at it, companies, drug companies are a great example, spend a fortune to pick the right name for a drug. Companies pay whatever they sell. They spend, lots of time, lots of effort finding the right name that will convey the right sense, the right emotion, the right, feelings about their product. And to me, neurodivergent has a very negative sound to it. It just comes across, if you don't know what it means, first off, it's hard to approach. You can't just break it down and say, oh, I can figure out what that means. It is, hard to approach. And I'm convinced that when you use words like that people don't understand, that makes them feel stupid. And nobody likes to feel stupid. So they turn it around and say, you're the arrogant jerk that's making me feel stupid. And I've been the arrogant jerk for enough of my life before I was diagnosed. I don't need to, self-inflict any more of that on myself. I use the term neurodistinct. And neurodistinct is really framing much better. First off, people can pick it apart by themselves pretty easy. Neuro, brain, thinking, even if they get close. And distinct, it stands out in some way. Well, most people in life want to stand out in some way, whether it's, be a great in their family, be great on their job, be great in a sport. So I think neurodistinct is a far, far better framing. And there's a study out there. It's kind of interesting. It deals with the researchers. It took two shapes. One shape was a star, kind of like you'd see in a comic strip when somebody punched somebody, so that weird, kind of funky, all irregular star shape. And the other one was a blobby kind of rounded shape. And they came up with two totally fictitious words. So they sound like words, but they really have no meaning. And if I remember right, it was Kiki and Booba. And when they show that to the general population, 85% of the general population will say Kiki is the star and Booba is the rounded shape. So they just automatically associate, 85% associate it. But when you take autistic individuals, it's 58%. So in other words, we're not very good at discriminating how words impact other people. Because when you think 58% is barely above random chance of getting the shapes right. And when you look at the general population at 85%, we're really seeing that there is a strong tie-in between the way a word sounds and how people interpret it and what qualities they associate with it, which goes back to prove that's why companies spend millions and millions of dollars coming up with names. So that's why I don't like it. The other thing is, it has absolutely no, academic standing or reason as far as where it came from. It wasn't like neurodiversity, which, Judy Singer, there's an academic paper written about what neurodiversity is. Well, the neurodivergent was not in her paper whatsoever. Neurotypical was in her paper, but not neurodivergent. Neurodivergent came from an activist that came up with it because she thought it made everybody more inclusive, which is really funny when the root of divergent is, is to divide. So I don't know how dividing makes you more inclusive, but being distinct is not giving that separation. So that is why I don't like the word. Is I don't think it casts us in a positive light in the general public. And it also is people don't understand it. And until you sit down and explain the word to them. So I'd rather use a self-explanatory word that makes them think more positive thoughts towards us.
All right. Let's get into a little bit more about yourself.
Sure.
How do you deal with overstimulation?
That's an interesting question. I am an outgoing introvert is the way I like to refer to it. And to me, introvert and extrovert is how do you recharge? And shy and outgoing is how do you show up in the public? So I am definitely an outgoing kind of person. And I enjoy being around people. I enjoy, interacting. And I don't actually notice the drain that it puts on me while it's going on. Because I'm in the moment, I'm having fun, so I don't notice it until it ends. And when it ends, and then, there's a big crash because, you really did burn a lot of energy that, and cognitive resources that you didn't even notice because you were having such a good time interacting with cool people. And, I'd say just about everybody you meet's a cool person. I mean, once you spend time to get to know them. So my normal way of recharging is, my favorite, when I have the opportunity is I live here in Colorado and I'm, it's 15 minutes to my favorite trailhead, which is right at the, beginning of the Rocky Mountains. So I throw on a pack and, I go hiking and I'm not out sightseeing. I'm actually in my head, to the point where I've, just about walked over people because I'm not looking at where I'm going. I'm kind of, I'm in my own head. There's times, and I've hiked the same trail so many times that, I can You know, I could sit here and describe to you exactly what it was like and where it goes uphill and where it turns. I've hiked it where all of a sudden I realize I don't even remember that I went through, you know, a mile and a half of it, and it wasn't even aware. I mean, I was just in my head, and that's how I recuperate and recharge, is just get out away from people, away from distractions, away from electronics, you know, away from everything, and just spend peaceful, quiet time doing, you know, some good, solid exercise.
So nature is the one thing that kind of helps recharge you.
Yeah, I would say it's a combination of being in nature and the physical activity, I think, is helpful, because I think that burns off a lot of the hormones and such that accumulate as you're, you know, interacting and you're excited about it. And, you know, that's obviously generating hormones. But yeah, I much prefer being in nature doing that compared to going to the gym. And it's not the people at the gym. It's just standing on a treadmill and doing 5.5 miles on a treadmill over 2 hours or an hour and a half or something, to me is just painful. But doing the exact same thing, you know, hiking in the mountains is a pure joy.
Anyways, when you get called for a company to give a lecture to them, what kind of topics do you deal with?
It varies upon the company. I normally will meet with the people that are setting it up and find out what are they trying to accomplish with having me present to them. Because it varies. Some companies are looking to have an introduction to neurodiversity. I actually did a presentation last week for a company, and that what they really wanted was positioning neurodiversity into the broader subject of diversity. And diversity is a very big thing for this particular company. So they really wanted to understand how does it fit in so they can start integrating it into their diversity programs. And it was really cool. They actually had 1,000 out of 2,700 employees were on the virtual, and they were in 18 different countries. So, you know, a little bit of impact. And the woman who set it up, the DEI person, was just ecstatic. She said, phenomenal foundation to build neurodiversity now into it. On the other hand, you go to other companies, and other companies are looking more for just general awareness. What is neurodiversity? What are neurodistinct people? And, you know, I can only really talk from the lens of autism because I'm autistic and that's the only lens I got. But I certainly can say all the way through, this is my view from being autistic, but they also, you know, there's other groups in the neurodistinct, such as ADHD and dyslexia, and, you know, and they all have their own, you know, challenges, and they have their own strengths. But everybody's an individual. So no matter, you know, what group you go to, don't judge by one. Don't assume I'm, you know, the exemplar for all autistics, no more than any of you listening are the exemplar for, you know, whatever group you identify with. So it really just, it varies like that. But my focus is always really the workplace and, trying to get the workplace to be more accepting of people who think differently, which obviously autism, but again, any of the neurodistinct, the whole definition of neurodistinct I use is people who perceive, process, and think in a distinctly different manner than neurotypicals. You want to listen to those people because they have different perspectives, and that's just like any other diversity. Why do we want diversity? Because we want those perspectives.
All right. What kind of response have you got from your talks? I mean, do people come up to you and thank you because you've kind of opened their minds to the neurodiverse?
Yeah. I would say every now and then you get somebody that makes a negative comment, but you know, there's haters everywhere. So you just, you know, deal with that. But that is not by any means the majority. That's very, very rare. Overall people very, very much, you know, enjoy it because they've now seen an aspect of humans that they never understood before. And more often than not, especially if it's a larger company, and when I say larger, you know, more than 500-600 people or something, you'll get people that come up and go, I worked with this person, I had this boss, and I just never understood, but now I get it. because nobody's ever explained to them what, you know, in my case, autism is. You know, it's not Rain Man. It's not Sheldon. That's all they know. They don't know better than that. So actually, you know, having a real live person, and, you know, I would say what probably helps me a fair amount was I've had quite a bit of training in public speaking and in being able to relate to audiences. So I come across more in a manner that they can relate to, because I'm talking in the tones and the senses of how they expect communication to be, which, you know, isn't the way us autistics tend to communicate. We tend to use words, and that's it. Our words, mm-hmm. We're done with the words. To me, I'm not masking, though. I've done it to the point now where it's just a skill that is just part of me. And it's improved my outcome in life and improves my interaction with other people, my delivery of the message, that, you know, whatever it happens to be for that particular audience. And I think that also helps a lot, because people can now personally identify. And when you can personally identify, I think that's really the trick of what it takes to get people to start accepting, is when they start personally identifying with somebody from whatever the group was. I mean, if you think of the LGBTQ, you know, plus group, what was it that got them acceptance? What got them acceptance was when finally enough of them stood up and started saying, we're here and I'm gay, I'm whatever. And people started going, oh, I went to school with that person. I liked him at school. You know, that's my brother. Oh, that's my uncle. And when you finally were able to make that human connection to them, it then removed the stigma, because now they're just a person, which is really who we all are. We're just all people.
Now, let's go back to neural distinct for a minute.
Sure.
Have you heard people accept that? And have you heard them using it?
Yeah, yes. At the major global tech company I work with, that is the official term that we use for all outbound reach stuff. You know, we've had all different things. But yes, that is the term. It was actually presented at a medical conference that was around design and innovation in medicine in Australia. And it was a tremendous, tremendous reception to it. It's really interesting. When you talk to autistics, it tends to get pushed back. But when you talk to non-autistics, they embrace the word instantly. Mm. Because they, well, you know, think of it this way. If you walked up to the street and just said to somebody, you're divergent, you're probably going to get smacked. But if you walked up to them and said, you're distinct, they're probably going to say, oh, thank you. So I think that's why, you know, the embracing of it. And I think why autistics don't is, you know, kind of like I said in that study, we don't have necessarily that sense of how the word has an association and effect, combined with, you know, what's one of the definitions of autism, rigidity and thinking. We learned another word. This is the word we learned. This is the word I'm going to use because it's the word I learned.
It's the AB thinking. It's the black and white thinking. It's the fact that we only see in two things. We don't see that center road. It's like, oh, there's a change in there. It's sort of like my mom says to me when I'm trying to cook something, she's like, you know, you don't have to follow the recipe to the T. You can change it here and there to your liking.
Right. And she's 100% right with that. But yeah, I think you're right. It's that polarization in thought that says I can't change it. But when we look at many other groups, and you know, I won't say I'm going to get this in a chronological order correct. But you know, when I was growing up, people of color were referred to as Negroes, and it wasn't derogatory or anything. That was, you know, even the term they used for themselves. That was just the terminology of the time. And then it moved to being, I think, Black was the next one, or it might have been African American. I don't remember the progression, but the term changed, and suddenly now we refer to people of color, which is the current term, as being either Black or African American, and then whichever one it was, we turned to the other one. So it's very common in groups and in, you know, the English language to have the words you use evolve to fit, you know, what are the current needs? What are the current, you know, things that you're trying to accomplish with or for that group? And again, you know, it's that, I refer to it as binary thinking, just hanging on to, no, this is the word I know, and any other one is wrong. But when we look at it, it's so common for words to have changed and evolved over time, and we replace it with other words. So I think, you know, why shouldn't we use a word that, if we were to go have $1 million to spend with the high-end marketing company, I guarantee you neurodivergent is not the word they would ever come up with. So I say, why not change it? Neurodistinct works well. It still fits ND. So all of us who talk about NT, ND, we don't have to change that. ND still works just perfectly fine. But, you know, that I think is part that we don't necessarily accept as autistics, is the fact that terminology changes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big issue with those of us who are autistic. We don't adhere to change. We can't deal with change in the rest of the world, because with us, it's everything becomes a pattern. And you throw that monkey wrench into the pattern, and it's like, oh shit, what do I do now?
I have the same problem. You know, I talk about, I call it the bread story. So this is one of my common presentation stories. In my presentations, I use a lot of personal stories because, you know, stories relate to people. And the bread story is, you know, dealing with the fact that I, like a lot of us autistic individuals, always eat the same, you know, same thing for over and over and over again. And, you know, my tends to be about 2 years till I finally burn out on that one and move to something else. And in the bread story, I was eating roast beef sandwiches on potato bread. And of course, you know, as you know, being a another autistic, it couldn't be any potato bread. It had to be a specific brand of potato bread. And the story, just quickly, because people get a kick out of it, is, you know, my wife and I would go shopping. We'd step in the aisle where the bread was, and this store didn't tend to put it in the same place all the time. So you couldn't just go to the same spot. You had to actually, you know, find it on the shelf. And I would be reading the end of the labels and looking for, you know, first brand name. And once I found brand name, then, you know, trying to find the right variety. And my wife would inevitably just point and go, oh, honey, it's right over there. And she did this like in 5 seconds. You know, I mean, I've read like 7 labels and she's already pointing at it. And it took me a year and a half before I finally asked her. You know, I guess that's the male trait right there, is, you know, you can't ask. So finally I asked her, how do you do that? And what she said was very eye-opening to me. And she said, it's really simple. I just look at the orange circle that's on the end of the wrapper, and it's the only bread that has an orange circle in the wrapper. and I'm not have any deficiencies with, you know, seeing color. I have no problems in that area. So when she pointed to the orange, I could see the orange clear as could be, but to me, the information was in the words. So I wasn't even paying any attention to the colors. She is very, very, first off, she's ADHD. So she's looking at everything all the time. And, you know, secondly, she's very, very color oriented. So to her, it was just find a pattern that I can identify with, and that will help me find the thing. I'm thinking, you know, because this is the way I process, the words are going to tell me the right information. Well, obviously she had a much superior method, but I do have to say, I did finally win. Finally, not on the bread though. We were shopping for her coffee about 2 months ago. And we were in a store we go to frequently. And we're in the coffee aisle, and we're hunting for a coffee. And she comes up to me and says, oh, honey, they don't have my coffee here. We're going to need to go somewhere else. And I reach up and grab the box and say, it's right here. they had rebranded, but the words were still the same. So again, it's not saying that her method was better and my method was worse. It just depends upon the situation, but it does show how differently humans can perceive. And how you perceive is going to obviously drive what your world is, because that's, you know, dictates what gets through.
Well, it's kind of like how Dr. Temple Grandin says it. There are different types of thinkers out there. There are visual thinkers, which is like you, because like your wife, because she sees the visual item, the visual picture. You see the words.
Right.
And so you two think so differently. So, but yet you're able to define the words because of the rebranding. The rebranding means the image change, but the words stay the same.
Exactly. So, you know, in the case of looking for something that didn't change, she had a method that was definitely, you know, superior. But when looking for something that has variability in it, my method was better, because you're examining more of the detail level versus the, you know, I'd say more impression level. So not one right, not one wrong, just situational as to which one would be the better approach.
Anyways, I see that you work for Microsoft.
No, actually, I work for the big G company. So Microsoft's actually my, they're one of the competitors.
You work for Google.
Yeah.
What was it like working for Google, and how do they handle neurodiversity? Do they have their own program? I know Microsoft has it. Is Google trying to implement something like that?
You know, they're working towards it. I will say that they have been slower than many other companies in moving ahead in that area. And Microsoft, I'm very, very familiar with Microsoft. Neil Barnett's a gentleman that runs Microsoft's program. Wonderful, wonderful guy. Actually just emailed with him a couple of weeks ago. They have a phenomenal program. They've been, you know, very much a leader in that for, well, since the Autism at Work kind of program started, what, 7 or so years ago, they've been one of the leaders. SAP, you know, another one of the leaders. No, I would say we're more at the stage of they're recognizing now that they do need to accept it. They're using it through their DEI efforts to engage with other companies, particularly partners and such. I've been on a number of their DEI efforts when me and a couple of the other autistic and other neurodistinct category people are, you know, the frequent three or four that, you know, are always doing these things. And, you know, they're definitely, you know, aware of it. They're aware that it's a big, huge growing thing. But Google's an interesting culture. I love it. I'm really enjoying it there. It's a great place to work. But when I say it's an interesting culture, you know, most companies are, you know, fairly structured. And not that they don't give you individual flexibility, but nonetheless, you can easily figure out, okay, who do you go to get something approved? And, you know, where do you go? And, you know, there's enough structure that you can figure those things out. Google has always been huge on self-empowerment. You know, the 20% project kind of things, where you just work on some project that you want to do because you want to do it. And, you know, that kind of stuff. So what I've really seen is, while there is lots of interest and effort going towards it, and a lot of the effort has actually been on the autism community's side, to be honest, we've put on presentations for the entire company and all that kind of stuff. There's not a cohesion across the company tying all the efforts together. So, you know, that's, I guess why, you know, Google often has multiples of the same products, is because it isn't being run from top down. It's being run from, you know, more individual initiatives. And, you know, like usual, when a good idea comes up, it comes up for a bunch of people at the same time. Mm. So, you know, I'm actually very, very excited. It's moved now from being a recruiting program, it's moved into the DEI realm, which is, I think, where Autism at Work needs to be placed, is it needs to be placed into DEI, because really that's what the problem is. You know, for all practical purposes, you know, we're our own culture. And, you know, there's an autism culture, there's an ADHD culture, there's a, you know, there's even a neurodistinct culture, which is kind of an umbrella over the whole thing. And then underneath it, there's, you know, all our individual cultures. And the recruiting type programs, to me, don't solve the problem, because you haven't taught the company to accept a different culture, because you haven't explained the culture to them yet. Mm. which is what we do with all other aspects of DEI. We, you know, educate somebody about this is what this culture is about. This is, you know, what they came through. This is their background. This is their, you know, you'll learn about the culture so that you recognize, oh, you know, they're not, they didn't grow up the same place I did. They had a different experience. They're going to, you know, act, talk, whatever, in a different way. Not better, not worse, you know, just like my wife and I, not like one's better or one's worse. They're just different culture, you know? So I think that's good that it's moving into the culture area, because at that point, that changes the entire organization into, you know, acceptance. Whereas hiring programs are really good from the standpoint that you can count them. So you know, management likes things that you can count and you can put numbers on. It's much harder to quantify acceptance and integration. But I think that's what we need, is we need to where people, you know, can understand that just because, you know, maybe I don't look you in the eyes when I talk to you, doesn't mean that I'm being dishonest and lying. It just means that that is not my style of talking. And while it's certainly associated with autism, my understanding is in the Native American culture with a lot of the tribes, that is very disrespectful to look somebody in the eye, particularly if they're older than you are. So, you know, it's just a matter of learning the culture, that you need to understand that in this culture, they act this way. And that doesn't mean they're being disrespectful. They're being, you know, bad. They're being mean. They're whatever. It just means they're being who their culture is. So I'm excited. I'm excited where it's going. I'm excited where it's moving forward. You know, I'm excited about the energy that's you know, around it and happening. So, you know, what one thing that is interesting is we with the DEI people and such we're working with, neurodistinct is the term, and it's very simple of how we explain it. We're Google. We don't repeat the past. We build the better future.
True. That's why I've always been an Android lover and a follower of Android. Since Google first came out with Android, the Android OS, I've been a follower of that since day one. And I said, that's going to be the mobile operating system of the future.
Certainly is the largest number of phones. That's for sure.
That's for sure. Now, when did you start advocating for yourself?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting story even there. When I was diagnosed, which I'm 62 now, I was diagnosed at 54. So goes back, you know, a few years. And it just so happens, had nothing to do with getting diagnosed. It just happened, you know, at the same general range of time. My wife and I were attending seminars from, well, the first one was a self-improvement type seminar. That isn't exactly how I'd classify it, but in close enough. And when you go to a lot of those things, it's very common for them when they have, you know, one seminar to then have like this phenomenal great deal to go to another, one of the type of things that they offer. And they, you know, offered another one that was called Experts Academy. And Experts Academy was all about teaching you how to take your knowledge, whether it's lived experience knowledge or learned knowledge from school. I mean, it doesn't matter. How do you take what you know and monetize it in some manner? Well, that sounded interesting. I mean, I, you know, been an entrepreneur, ran my own business from a startup for 10 years, which, you know, means I beat 95% of the, you know, people who start businesses. You know, I did very well in the IT world, you know, had lots of things I could potentially have talked about. But first you got to learn how to go about doing it before you even have to worry about which, you know, one of those things are you going to do. And that was very interesting. Learned a huge amount about that. It's actually what led me to finally writing the book Geek's Guide to Interviews was, okay, if I've now learned all the things to monetize it, I now need to go at least do one. And so I decided I'd write the book, and that was the book I wrote. But then they offered another seminar that was called World's Greatest Speaker. And World's Greatest Speaker was four different individuals presenting how to be a world-class public speaker. and not through the, through the Toastmasters approach, but of really more from the entertainment industry approach of how to really connect and with people, not just how to not say, you know, I got plenty of ums in there, trust me. But we went to this and two of the different speakers, one of the speakers was a vocal coach and, you know, arguably the best vocal coach in the world. And another one was a gentleman that, first he was a NFL football player, quite good. And then he ended up being a Broadway actor and was an acclaimed Broadway actor in a one-man play that he wrote himself. And he was just phenomenal in how you tell stories. So we liked both. I mean, we really connected with both those people. So we ended up then going to their seminars. And so we're now doing these things simultaneously, both these seminars. My wife and I were like flying out to California every other week. We were just like flying to California because they're all in California. And people thought we were crazy because like most people don't do these things simultaneously. they do them serially. But, you know, hey, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. I just dove in. And we were actually at the one that was the Broadway actors seminar. And we were in a theater and there was about 200 people there. And it was expensive. I mean, a couple thousand bucks a person to be there. And we had to come up with a story to tell. And you got together in a group, you know, four or five people, you know, so you just kind of paired up with whoever, you know, was around you that you thought you wanted to pair up with. And you worked on the story and you told the story to each other. And you first had to do it as a 3-minute story. And then they sent you back together to get together with a different group and now cut it down to a 2-minute story. And then they had you get together with a different group, now make it a 1-minute story. And then everybody had to go up on stage one by one and deliver their story in one line. And I went up and it was the first time I ever openly talked about being autistic. And my one line was, I'm not like you. I'm autistic. And the response was, I didn't know how the response was going to be. Who knows? I mean, I'm autistic. I didn't care what they were going to think. That was, that was my story. But the response was just overwhelmingly positive of people that, you know, had autistic kids, and things like that. I mean, I had one person come up that did have autistic children and were just so thankful for actually being willing to stand up and say, I'm autistic, not like it has shame, but that's just who I am. So that's how it started. It just craziest, you know, kind of thing. And so that became what I talked on. And now, I don't know, I do it way too much.
Now, what was the feeling you had when you found out you had autism? I mean, was it like a light bulb going off above your head? Was it a sense of relief that you're different than everyone else, but that's why you're different?
Well, I already knew I was different than everybody else. My working theory up to that point was that virtually everybody in the world was stupid. Now, it wasn't really effective. Trust me, it wasn't. You know, it wasn't a good working theory, but nonetheless, it did seem to match the observations of if I can get this stuff so easily and nobody else does, then obviously there's some kind of deficit going on. Well, when I was diagnosed, now it put it all into perspective. And what became quite obvious is the deficit wasn't in their intellect. The deficit was in the communications between ourselves. That there was essentially, there were words that went back and forth, but there wasn't communication happening. This is a George Bernard Shaw quote. It's actually pinned up in my office. And it is the worst thing about communication is the assumption that it happened. Right? I mean, how many times you say something, you assume the other person got what you meant, but the reality is they didn't get what you meant. They got a different picture from what you meant. I actually teach and train on that a lot. I use it a lot when I'm talking. And the way I often present it usually is, if I say the word beach, what comes to your mind? And for most people, it's white sand, palm trees, you know, pina colada in their hand, maybe, you know. I grew up in upstate New York, and I canoed a lot. I was a Boy Scout, you know, loved canoeing, loved being in the outdoors. And I went canoe camping one time and camped out on a little island that was in a lake that had a little circular beach. It was small, about 10 minutes max to walk around the whole beach all the way around. But that's the most memorable beach to me is a beach in the middle of fresh water surrounded by pine trees and mountains. So if I just say, geez, I love being at the beach, people are going to get the completely wrong idea of what beach it is that to me is the one that's relaxing, because I don't like the ocean beaches, to be honest with you. There's like big things that swim in there. Just like, it creeps me out. So,
yeah, go on.
You know, I say that that's, you know, I think a big challenge that we have is the whole communication thing. And that's really what became clear to me once I was diagnosed and then started, you know, be like any good, you know, Aspie. And I still like to use the term Asperger's. That's what I was diagnosed with at the time. And I think it better defines who I am than saying, you know, ASD level one, or saying, you know, HFA, high functioning autism. But, you know, as I always say, anybody can use any word they want for themselves. I'm more than willing to respect it, even if everybody else has moved on to something else. So just, you know, I ask people to respect that this is the word I like to stick with. So, you know, like any good Aspie, though, what did I do? I mean, that became my special interest now, trying to understand autism, because, you know, I just found out that's what I was. And, you know, and I recognized then it was a communication deficit was really the problem of, I was saying, you know, the things the way I thought about them and saw them, and people were not receiving and getting the same concept in their mind because their communication style was different. I'm convinced that neurotypicals and a lot of the other neurodistinct categories use three modes of communication. And of course, there's the words, obviously, but there's tonality in the voice. And the tonality in the voice can take and totally flip around the meaning of words. I mean, you can say, you know, oh, that was the best meeting I was ever in. And, you know, if you're at all good at following tonality, and I suck at following it, I just got really good by being trained of how to give it. But that tonality is actually negating what the words are saying. So in other words, I'm really saying sarcastically, that meeting sucked.
I mean, that's why we have such a problem with communications, is someone can say something and we can't even tell if it's a joke or not, because we can't tell. We don't hear the tone in the voice. And we'll be just looking with a blank stare at someone like, were you joking or are you serious?
Right. And, you know, it's really funny that even though I was taught how to put the emotional sounds and tonality in my voice, it's been phenomenal for getting the connectivity and the improving the communication to other people, but it didn't do anything for my ability to interpret that on the inbound side. So I have that exact same problem with that. I take things literally. I mean, there's another story
here.
You know, there was another story that I tell, you know, frequently, and I had a manager, and it was first day I was on vacation. And she contacted me and said, I want to meet with you. Well, I've been fired enough times to know that's usually not a good sign when they want to meet with you on the first day of your vacation. So I'm going into this with already a, you know, expectation of a negative outcome. And we're going along, talking along. And she says to me, Tim, I think you should look for a new job. So my response back to her was, isn't this when we're supposed to call HR in? I assumed I was getting fired. Well, you know, after working with HR long enough and all that stuff, we finally got down to it. And what I totally missed, and that what she really meant, and she wasn't really always good at expressing in words what she meant. And English was a second language for her. So not, you know, in valid reasons, possibly. What she really meant was, I can see this position in, you know, that you're in now, which was being a, implementation consultant, but you had to juggle 15 customers. And you know, anybody who's ever juggled multiple customers knows that they all have an emergency on the same day. It's just the way it works. And that would, of course, put me into overwhelm and, things go downhill.
Meltdown, shut down, and everything.
Well, I wouldn't really melt down. I would, for me, I would try to rise to the occasion. But on the other hand, my decision making and such and my communications would degrade, even though I, wasn't shut down. But I was certainly...
So you were almost like me in the sense where you go into a panic mode, but you're able to assess the situation, keep yourself calm, and figure everything out.
Yeah, except of course, all the things you're doing at a diminished level than you normally do because your body is stressed out and reacting as such.
That brings up a great story. It's like I think I told you this when we last talked. When I was first going away to school across the seas, we get to the airport, my mom and dad, and the guy at the gate goes. At the counter goes, oh, only one parent's allowed with because of 9/11. My mind is in overload already because all the sounds, all the smells, all the noise, all the lights, and the excitement of going away. And I break down. I can't control my own emotions at that point. I start crying and I'm pleading. And finally, my dad just goes, he'll go with his mother. So fortunately, there was a glass wall between the gate and where my father was with a guard. My dad was able to sit behind the glass wall. My mom sat with me in the waiting area by the gate. And by the time the call went for the boarding, it's like a light switch. Mm-hmm. I went from crying to like excited.
Yep. Yep. So I say, yeah, similar kind of thing. But what ended up happening was when HR explained, she was actually, I missed her tonality. What she was really expressing was concern for how that was affecting me. Mm. And so when she said, I think you should look for another job, she was, probably more a better concerned. Way to have phrased it would have been, I'm concerned about how this is affecting you. And I think maybe some other roles would just, be better for your mental health than this particular role is. But she instead put it into tonality, which I totally missed. So I took, I think you should look for a new job as being, I think I should look for a new job.
That must have been such a relief when you found that out.
It was, I don't know. I'd say I've been fired enough times that I don't get too worked up over the whole thing.
Anyways, what was your family's reaction when they found out you had autism?
Well, my daughter, I have a daughter. She's 35. So she wasn't living at home. She's, when she went to college, she moved out and then, always stayed off on her own. So it didn't really have a direct effect on her necessarily, but my wife was hallelujah. Now it finally makes sense why I'm always wondering who it is that's going to walk in the door each evening.
So it was almost like Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, I mean, it is. If you're, if you had a rough day, you're stressed out, you're wound up, or you're excited and you're bouncing off the ceiling, or you're just in a I've had people out. I've just like dealt with way too many people today. And I just like, don't even want to hear anybody talk to me anymore. I'm done for the day. So she, would never know. So it was, it was definitely a relief. I wouldn't say it was a relief immediately. It was a relief once, both she and I started understanding really what it really meant. Because at first, when you decide, hey, you're autistic, you have Asperger's, it's like, oh, okay, big deal. So, but I have blue eyes too. So what, what's that got to do with anything in the world? But then once you start understanding what it means, it then started becoming very, very obvious some of the frictions we had. That's where they came from. And just understanding that that was the problem. It's a lot like the, when we talk, a lot of autistics, I used to be until I, was trained to not, I used to be very monotone and, monotone is interpreted as being disengaged, not interested. And if you don't make eye contact and you're monotone, then you're really being thought of as being, you're just like blowing the other person off. But once they understand that what autism is, and oh, I'm dealing with somebody who's autistic, then suddenly now you can understand that, no, it's not that. That's not meaning that they're disengaged and not interested. If they were disengaged and not interested, they wouldn't be using words with me. They'd be walking away. So, you know, same thing. Once we started understanding more, it definitely helped, you know, improve the relationship. And we've been married. It's going to be 38 years this now. So, you know, we've you know, been through, you know, some definite highs and lows and, you know, been through the trenches.
All right. Congratulations on 38 years.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, what would you say to someone who just got diagnosed with autism this late in life?
I would say, congratulations. You're lucky. Well, from two, you know, a couple standpoints. I mean, first off, they're lucky that they got diagnosed, particularly late in life. You know, late in life diagnoses are much more, you know, infrequent than getting diagnosed in school nowadays. Mm-hmm. So they were lucky, because once you do understand that's who you are and you start learning some about it, it does make it easier to navigate and deal with the world, because you know, you can recognize that, okay, you know, autistics tend to be binary thinkers and kind of rigid in their thinking. Well, okay. Yeah. Okay. I can see that in myself now. And, you know, makes it easier to deal with it when you understand what it is versus thinking that's the right way. And, you know, so that's one thing of why I say they're lucky. And, you know, I think being autistic is actually a darn good thing for a lot of us. It's Temple Grandin, of course, you know, is the one who says that, but if it wasn't for autistic individuals, you know, the human race would still be, in a cave, or I can't remember what the exact quote is, but essentially that, you know, you needed these people that think differently, that aren't feeling constrained by everything, or we wouldn't be where we are right now.
All right. Have you taught yourself any shortcuts since you found out you had autism, like things to help you navigate the world?
I wouldn't say I taught myself so much. And again, it was happenstance. The whole learning to communicate from entertainers. I mean, that's really, you know, who I learned from is the entertainment world. Learning to communicate from what are probably the best communicators in the world. When you think about it, who are the best communicators in the world? Singers and actors. You know, they're probably the best communicators in the world. So I was taught by, you know, people who teach the world's top singers and actors. And that has made more difference in my life than I think anything else. So that definitely has been a huge, huge thing. And again, it wasn't done because I was autistic. It was happenstance that, you know, I just right place, right time, willing to give things a go. And oh my gosh, you know, I hit the jackpot on that one. So that may have definitely made a big difference. I can't really think of anything else that, you know, particular. I guess the other thing would be greater acceptance. You know, recognizing that just because, well, again, I came from the point of thinking the rest of the world was stupid. You know, moving from concept that the rest of the world was stupid to the concept that, no, it's a communication challenge is really the problem. That makes you then start becoming more aware and more open to people who are different. What are those differences that you need to bridge over? So I think I've become far more accepting of other people. And, you know, I might not agree with them, but I've learned to disagree respectfully as opposed to, just think they're flaming, you know, a-holes.
And lastly, where can people find out more about you?
Best place is just head to my website. It's timgoldstein.com, TimGoldstein.com.
And that's it. Thank you so much, Tim, and everyone. I'll leave a link in the description down below in the show notes so you can find out more about him. That was Tim Goldstein. Thanks, Tim, for such a wonderful show.
Hey, thank you very much, Reed, for having me. Very much enjoy chatting with you.
Not a problem. Till the next one, everyone.
How I miss the way things used to be. I'm no big fan of now. I must have some sweeter memories somewhere in the cloud. Welcome to the new normal. Welcome to the new normal. Welcome to the new normal. Shout. Welcome to the new normal. Welcome to the new normal. Welcome to the new normal. Shout. Gonna miss all you used to be. Gonna miss all you had. Consigned to the dustbins of history like opinions from your dad. Welcome to the new normal. Welcome to the new normal. Welcome to the new normal. Shout. Welcome to the new normal. You can talk to the freaks. You can talk to just about anybody you happen to meet. It ain't what it was, and it is what it is. Time.